Well, good evening, and welcome to tonight's concert. We've got a good lineup tonight. Got Cajun music and some of the hottest dulcimer music you ever seen. And I thought we'd start tonight with a couple of stories. Maybe we'd start with a little song. Muskrat, oh muskrat, what makes your tail so slick? I've been living in the swamp so darn long, lucky I ain't sick, Lord, oh lucky I ain't sick. Groundhog, oh groundhog, what makes your back so brown? I've been digging in the dirt so darn long, trying to make my home in the ground. Lord, I'm digging my hole in the ground. Rooster, oh, rooster, what makes your spurs so hard? I've been scratching my barn in your barnyard all of my life, and Lord, I'm getting tarred now. Oh, Lord, I'm getting tarred. Redbird, oh, redbird, what makes your head so red? I've been eating your corn so darn long, lucky I ain't dead. Lord, oh, lucky I ain't dead. Bullfrog, oh, bullfrog, what makes your back so green? I can hide in the weeds in the swamp, and there I'll never be seen. Lord, oh, there I'll never be seen. Chipmunk, oh, chipmunk, what makes your cheeks so round? I've been gathering them seeds and them nuts, I'm gonna store them in my hole in the ground. Lord, take them in my hole in the ground. Caterpillar, oh caterpillar, don't you hate to creep and crawl? I'll be flying high one day and I don't mind at all. Lord, oh, I don't mind at all. Rattlesnake, oh rattlesnake, what makes your teeth so white? I've been sitting in the sun so darn long, lucky I don't bite, Lord, oh, lucky I don't bite. All right, all right. Well, my name's Doug Elliott, and I've been teaching the basketry this week, and going to be teaching woods lore and herbs next week. We're going to do a lot of roaming around in the woods, and I thought I'd give you a little wood lore here tonight. I want to talk to you about a critter that's found in practically every woodlot and cow pasture between Canada and those North Georgia hills. This critter I want to tell you about is a groundhog. Now, you know, I got talking with some of my neighbors. I live down in the mountains of North Carolina, and I was talking to some of my Yancey County neighbors, and I was talking to them about groundhogs, and they were saying, now, buddy, when times was tough and we was coming up around here, I mean, there'd be some days when we'd get up and there wouldn't be anything for breakfast but a little piece of cold cornbread, and there weren't nothing for lunch, and about supper we'd have a few beans and some cornbread. Now, times was tough, buddy, and when we got onto a good groundhog, buddy, we were glad to get a groundhog. I mean, and they're pretty good eating, you know, and oh, you just cook them right, they're quite good. And I got asking them, I said, well, do you still shoot these groundhogs out in your pasture and all? Do you still eat them? And they were saying, nah, we don't eat them much anymore. Nah, well, you still shoot them, don't you? Yeah, we shoot them. What do you do with them? Oh, we just throw them in the creek or let the dogs eat them, tear them up or something like that, you know. And, Well, you know, that started to just bother me a little bit. You know, and I should have known better, but I started preaching, and I started, you eat these groundhogs if you're going to shoot them. I mean, you don't want to waste them. They're good meat. Well, we get good meat. We buy good meat at the store, and we got a freezer now. We put up pork all, have enough to last us the whole year, and we kill that old little veal calf. We got all the meat we need, you know, you're going to kill them. You ought to just use them. And they said, well, I'll tell you what, next time we get one, we'll bring one to you, and you can have him. We'll bring you all we get, matter of fact. And I thought, all right. And it didn't take long. About a week or so later, I see my neighbor Lige, old-timer, coming up the trail. I see him kind of leaning low on one side, and he said, Doug, I got you a groundhog. And I looked, he handed me this big old groundhog. It was heavy. And he says, buddy, this is a fat one. Buddy, he's been out there laughing at me in my corn patch all summer. And I tell you, I finally got him, buddy. He's a fat one. He's corn-fed now. Now, buddy, they'll be good eating now. He'll be good eating now. You know, you got to clean him. You just take out all that fat, and you don't take them little kernels out from under his arms there. You know, you think you had gamey pits. Well, you ought to, you know. And he says, you take them out there and you parboil them and you cook them. He'll be good. And I said, well, thank you. I guess I will. And then just as Lodge was about to leave, he says, now wait, be sure you save that hide now. And I said, save the hide? What would I do with the hide? He says, oh, it ain't nothing better than a groundhog hide, bud. They're the handiest thing to have around the house. I mean, they're just the best thing to have around. I mean, you can do everything with a groundhog. Well, what could I do? He says, well, now, bud, the first thing, if he's making you a banjo, you just stretch that hide over the over a banjo head, buddy. That'll make the best music you ever heard. Well, I wasn't planning on making any banjos, you know, but that was kind of interesting to see how he said, well, I said, now, shoelaces, buddy. Boots for your shoes and your bootlaces, he says. Ain't nothing better than groundhog hides. And I thought, well, now, bootlaces, huh? Well, how would I do that? I said, they got hair all on them. He said, now, what you do is, he says, you lay that hide in like a dish pan, and you get you lay a bunch of wood ashes in there and put some water in with it and let it just sit. Let it sit for a few days, up to a week maybe, and then you scrape it loose. And you scrape all those hairs off when the hairs start to slip, and then you end up with this hide, and you just take that hide and you tan it. I said, well, how do I tan it? He says, just rub it over the back of a chair somewhere, just from the time it's wet to the time it's dry. You just rub it over the back there and see if you can get it soft. And I thought, now a shoelace, or at least for some of my boots, they have to be about this long. I said, how do you get a shoelace this long out of a groundhog hide this big? And he says, why, you just cut it in a little spiral, just right around. Well, okay, that's a good little suggestion. Well, now, I was kind of intrigued by that here this animal, a lot of people consider it a varmint, and here it is not only food, but you can make music with it. And here you can actually use it as a functional item, used for a thong or for a shoelace. And then I got thinking about this a little more, and Elijah just about leaves. He says, now, be sure you render out all that grease. I said, render out the grease. I said, what would I do with that? He says, oh, buddy, there ain't nothing better than groundhog grease. No, sir, there ain't nothing better. I said, nothing better than groundhog grease. What do you do with it? He said, buddy, when you get a cold or a croup, and when the children take the croup, buddy, you just drink you a little bit of it. You just render that and just drink it. I said, how does that help you? He says, oh, yeah, now there's things I've tasted that taste better, buddy, but it'll help you, is what he said. It'll help you. And I said, how do I render it out? He says, just render it out in a frying pan and just pour the grease off. Well, so I got into that whole project. Well, I tell you, I took that groundhog and I cooked him up, and sure enough, I did all they told me. I parboiled him. I took him out on the barbecue. I put some barbecue sauce on him, and he was delicious, you know, just absolutely good eating. And I got to thinking about, you know, what a groundhog eats, and all the groundhogs eat are just the little bitty green tips of your garden, you know, the youngest, best tasting plants, the mildest tasting ones. That's what they eat. So, of course, their meat tastes mild. And then, sure enough, I took that hide and I worked that hide over the back of a chair and I cut it into a spiral, and I kept it going, and it worked out It worked into a real tough shoelaces. In fact, on my dress shoes, I have groundhog hide tied right on there. If any of you want to come see them later on, you can have a look at my groundhog hide shoelaces. And then I kind of rendered out that grease, and the grease came out to be real clear. And in fact, I even brought a little bottle of that here somewhere. Oh yeah. And look at it, just clear as can be. And if any of you want to come have a little sip of groundhog grease, or, you know, put a little behind your ear, you know, to kind of give you that earthy flavor, you know, you're welcome. After the concert, we'll have a little groundhog grease party, and we grease up, and, you know. Well, you know, after I rendered up some of that grease, I was just talking to some of my other neighbors, and I was just kind of, this gave me a little avenue for research, you know, and just kind of started asking around. And I found that, I started asking, well, now what about this groundhog grease? And I made up some little bottles of it, and I started bringing it around to my neighbors just to see if they'd want some. Well, sure enough, they did want some. And I talked to one fella, and he said, oh, buddy, he says, when the rheumatism's getting to me, that arthritis in my joints, he says, bud, there's nothing better than that groundhog grease. I drink that river yellow root tea, and then I lay the groundhog grease to it. Buddy, it's like a penetrating oil. It'll work right in there. It'll just penetrate right in those old knees, and it'll get right in those joints. And so, like, here it is, a liniment as well. And I started asking around another fella. He says, now, buddy, in the wintertime, he says, when I'm going to be going out hunting all day, or I'm going to go out there dragging wood in through the snow, and he says, now, I don't take a lot of baths in the wintertime, but he says, when I'm going to go out in that cold weather, what I do is I just take me a bath right beside the stove, and I just get there, and I'll get pink as I can be, and I just lay the groundhog grease to me, and I just grease up good, buddy. He says, I tell you, you slip on your clothes after you got that groundhog grease on you, they slide on smooth as silk. And buddy, he says, you can go out all day in that cold weather, you know, and the wind won't chap your face, and you can stay out there all day. I said, you mean it's like a skin conditioner? He says, that's exactly what it's like, buddy. That's exactly what it's like. And so I'm just amazed, you know. Here's this animal, we consider it a varmint, you know. In fact, any of you who've raised a garden in groundhog country probably know about what a varmint, a groundhog is, and what a nuisance they can be, how they'll just tear into your garden, and they seem to know whatever's just getting to the peak of its growth. They'll go right down that row of broccoli, that row of cabbage, right down the whole row. And in fact, a woman from Elkins was telling me that she had a real problem, because a groundhog took a liking for the hoses in her car. And that groundhog would climb up under her car, and it would chew the dickens out of those hoses until it had done like $300 worth of damage. And she said the only thing, she couldn't catch the groundhog. It would come in there whenever they weren't there. She couldn't catch it. And the only thing they knew to do was they had to fence their car. I mean, she had a Volkswagen Rabbit, and by God, she says, and she even brought me a picture, and I have that picture if you all want to see it. And she says, my rabbit in a cage, you know, and she'd drive it right onto a big old batch of chicken wire and fold the chicken wire up around the rabbit, and it was the only way they could keep that groundhog out of that car. Well, you know, I got to thinking about groundhogs more and more, you know, that sort of got to be like a fixation, and I got to noticing on the calendar. And I noticed that February 2nd, Groundhog Day, right? Well, I got to thinking, now Groundhog Day, I went all over that calendar. There's no Possum Day. There's no Raccoon Day. I mean, there's no Squirrel Day. Now, what in the world is Groundhog's Day all about? All right, I mean, now we know the groundhog comes out of his hole, he looks around, if he sees his shadow, that means it's a sunny day, right? He goes back into the ground and then hides. Now, if it's a cloudy day and the wind's blowing and it's snowing or something like that, he stays out. Now, what in the world has that got to do with anything? I mean, February 2nd, and we've all heard it since we've grown up, this whole Groundhog's Day expression. Well, as it turns out, this is the last remains we have of an ancient pagan holiday. And this was an ancient day of celebration. It's exactly the halfway point between the winter solstice and the spring equinox. And, you know, pagans been getting a lot of bad press lately. Well, actually, Christians have too, so, you know, I don't know. The score is about even these days. But, you know, I think it's important for us to understand the roots of what the word pagan means. Pagan is the Latin root of that is paganus, meaning a country person. And it has the same root as pagus, means the countryside. And what this was in Latin times, in early Roman times, you had the urban people. They were the people that lived within the cities. They had a more hierarchical society with laws and rules and distinctive leaders. Then you had the people that lived out in the country. They had a less of a hierarchical society. They had an earth-based religion where they were involved with the earth and its cycles, and they were the pagan people. And also the word heathen means a person of the heath. And they didn't really get a negative connotation until the Inquisition came on, and then it got heavy, you know. So I think it's kind of interesting. Like it's always said that if your wood supply or your food is not half gone by the time the February 2nd comes along, you'll make it through the winter. Like, even though it's not the coldest day of the year, I mean, even if it's not the shortest day of the year, it's like the time of the coldest weather. And the days are getting longer. You can see it if you watch the length of the days. But it's still the time when it's coldest, the end of January, the beginning of February, it's the coldest time. And yet, you can see that the days are getting longer. And so this was an ancient time of celebration for the spark of life. It's a time of fire and fertility. The flowers, the plants aren't quite germinating yet, but the spark of life is there. The Celtic people had a goddess they called Breed or Brigid, and as Christianity took hold, she got a Christian cloak, and now she's known as Saint Breed or Saint Brigid. And they would say a little invocation on Saint Bride's Day or Saint Breed's Day, Saint Bridget's Day. And they would say, they would build a little bed by their hearth, and they would ask her to sleep there on the hearth. And if she did, then that would guarantee fertility to the crops and to the livestock. But still this whole question of what in the world is this ground? Okay, so the groundhog, if he comes out of his hole and sees his shadow, that means if the sun's shining bright and it's a pretty day, he goes back in the ground and doesn't come out for 6 weeks. If it's a blizzardy day and the clouds are hanging heavy and he doesn't see his shadow, then he stays and we get springtime. Now, what is that all about? Well, as it turns out, this is a remnants we have of ancient bear and badger cults from Europe. The badgers and the bears would also go down into the ground and hibernate like the groundhog does. And they would go, and this was considered to be a time of rebirth and renewal. As we walk through this world, we have our light side and we have our dark side. We have our bright side and we have our shadow, our shade, the dark part of ourselves, the part that as autumn comes along gets longer, as the shadows get longer. And so we go into the earth, we go into a time, into the dark place. When you go down into the earth, into the depths, into the bowels of the Mother Earth, you no longer have a shadow. Everything's dark, there's no shadows anywhere. It's all darkness. And then as this creature would come out of the ground, if it has completely finished the rebirth cycle, it won't have any shadow. And it will come out and be reborn anew. If there's still a little bit of a shadow there, then it goes back in because the process is not complete. And that's where that custom came from. So then I got thinking, well now, what in the world is any self-respecting groundhog doing out in the middle of February? I mean, groundhogs eat greens, eat fresh plants. What's a groundhog doing out in February? How could this even come out associated with groundhogs? Well, one day, I was out in the woods, and where I live in North Carolina, it doesn't snow very often. And when it does, we get a couple of good snowstorms a year. And when it does, I just go to the mountains right away because I love to follow tracks. And I always find that you know, in the summer, you see a deer or you see a fox, and you get this little fleeting glimpse of this animal as it bounds away through the woods. But in the wintertime, whether you see the fox or the deer or whatever animal you happen to be looking for, you don't maybe see it, but you find its tracks. And that way you can follow those tracks and you can go through the woods and you can be with that animal for hours at a time. You can see everything that animal did. You can see where it dug in under a log. You can see where it climbed up on logs for a better view. You can see where it pounced on prey. You can see where it peed. I mean, you can be with that animal, you know? And so I love to go out and just follow tracks, and it gives me a sense of what animals live in the woods near me, and it gives me all kinds of indications of different kinds of animal behavior. It gives me ways of seeing what animals do and how they behave. And one day I was walking along and I saw through the snow, it was in the middle of February, and I see these tracks. And they had little paw prints, and I thought, oh, a raccoon. Oh, great, I haven't followed a raccoon for a long time. And I started following this raccoon, and I looked, and it was heading right for a stream. Well, that made sense, because raccoons, they get a lot of their food out of streams. They gather crawfish, and they gather salamanders, and they were grabbing, and they turn over rocks, and it's always interesting to see where a raccoon has worked. So I was following those tracks, and they didn't go up the stream at all. They went right across the stream and right on. And then just shortly when I got up the other side of the stream bank, I saw a couple of teeth marks, sharp cutting teeth marks in this vine. I realized, that's not a raccoon at all. That's a groundhog. Now, what's a groundhog doing out here in this snow? He didn't eat the vine. There were just two teeth marks as he walked by. Well, I followed a little longer, and then sure enough, there was a hole in the ground. And you could see where those tracks, there was a whole bunch of tracks in the front of it, and he'd gone down into this hole. And then he came back out again. You could see muddy footprints tracking him across the snow. And he went on around the mountain. And then came to another hole. Well, I see these footprints all over the front of that hole. And then he went down. You could see where he went down in. And you could see where he came out of that hole. Walked around the mountain. Went in another hole. By the time I got tired of following him, he'd gone in seven different burrows. And I found out later that the male groundhogs come out at this time of the year. They're not interested in eating. This is their mating season. And that's what this groundhogs were doing, is he was looking for a mate. And now, of course, tracks don't tell you everything, so I couldn't tell what went on in each of those holes. You know, it was hard to say, you know. But I was telling this to a Cherokee Indian friend of mine, and he says, oh, well, you know what they do, those groundhogs? I said, what do you mean what they do? When they get to the den? I said, well, what do they do? He says, well, what they do is he pounds his feet on the front of the den, and he whistles. And if there's a female in there and she's receptive, she'll come out and greet him. And this Indian said that when he was a boy living in the mountains near Cherokee, he would go right to these groundhog dens in the early spring, and he would pound his hands on the front of the den, and he'd whistle. And if she would come out, he'd have a stick ready and bam! He'd bring that groundhog home to his grandparents, and he would be praised no end for being that sensitive and that able to catch a groundhog with no knife, no gun, just by simple cunning on his part. And that just amazed me. And I realized that little bit of information you probably wouldn't learn from any mammalogy text. You know, this is just something that came from the Indians. And then it kind of dawned on me that, you know, well, the Indians had groundhogs, and I wonder how they fit into their general worldview. And so anytime in my travels I'd run into anyone of Native American descent, I would ask, you know, and I talked to one fellow who was a Lenape Indian. And he said, I said, how about groundhogs? He said, how do you regard them? And he said, oh, groundhogs, he says, medicine animals, important medicine animals. First of all, they know all the herbs. They live in the sunshine all the year, and they know all the plants. He says, we'd make our medicine drums out of that. Now, hang on, I've got a medicine drum. And so I took a hide and I stressed it over an oak frame, and made a drum. And I was amazed at the sound when I stretched that raw hide tightly. And I thought it might be fun. We might like to do just a brief Native American chant, and you can kind of get a little sense of the feel of the power of this drum. And the chant goes something like this. Uate lanyo lanyo mahate. Hainu, hainu, hainu. Now, you may have a little trouble catching up with the lyrics, but you know that hainu, hainu part you can probably get. And then it has a translation, a sort of a loose translation that I'll sing as we get into it. And I thought maybe we'd go through it three or four times, and then maybe I'll do the English translation of it and see if we can't get the place rocking here a little bit. Uate lanyo lanyo mahate, hainu, hainu, hainu. Uate lanyo lanyo mahate, hainu, hainu, hainu. We are one with the infinite sun forever and ever. Uate lanyo lanyo mahate, hainu, hainu, hainu. Just amazing the power of that. You know, that simple hide against a piece of wood, you know, and just with the reverberations of the air. And so then that, you know, that kind of got me interested, and I was talking to some other Indians, and I talked to a fellow from Cree tradition, and he said, I said, groundhogs, and he said, yeah, he said, my grandfather was named Groundhog. I said, your grandfather's named Groundhog, how would you say that in your language? And he says, Wijak. Aha! And as it turns out, that word woodchuck, which is the other northern name for groundhogs, is an English corruption of the Algonquin. He says some groups pronounce it winjak, and others wijak. But that's how we got the name. You know, I always wondered how much wood a woodchuck could chuck. And, you know, just if a woodchuck could chuck wood, it never really made sense to me, you know. And that sort of made it sort of come around. As I got, he said, another word which I learned from him, chipmunk. It's from the Algonquin. Achimonsi. And that means cute little critter that runs down the tree head first. And that's why we call them chipmunks, you know. He said, you know, they were important medicine animals for us, and they still are. He said, we consider them to be, they spend all the day in the fields. They know the plants. He said, just like the Lenape guy said. He said, and yet all half of the year, they spend down within the depths of the Mother Earth. And when they come out, during the other half of the year, they have the whistle of the eagle. And he says they work as an intermediary between Grandfather Sky and Grandmother Earth. And that's sort of one of the big dualities in a lot of Native American religions, is that these two powers, the Grandfather Sky that's so far away and so aloof and yet so present, and the Grandmother Earth who nurtures us and who we walk upon and who feeds us. And this being is the intermediary between these two elements in our life. And you know, I thought about that, and I thought, a lot of my neighbors don't call them woodchucks, and they don't call them groundhogs, they call them whistle pigs. And I think of these ones out across this, there's a big pasture that faces my house, and there's a few of them that live out there, and you see them out there sunning on rocks, or you see them out there feeding on the grass, and now and then I'll hear this kind of a call, this psh, and it sounds like this piercing bird call. And then I'll just go, you know, and whistle back at him. You know, I'll see him jump up and look around. I go, I gotcha. You know, we had this little game going back and forth, you know. And then this same guy was saying, you know, we always also consider them to be a real image for a warrior. We consider them to be the real image that a warrior should watch and observe. And I said, how's that? He says, whenever they get into any trouble, they head for their den as quick as possible. And I said, uh-huh. He says, but if you ever get between one and its den, they will fight like tigers. And I thought about that a little bit, and I remembered one time when I was living up north, up in New Hampshire, I had a friend who had a real feisty border collie, and that border collie's just reason for being, his whole raison d'etre, was to chase groundhogs, and that was basically all right. You know, he never seemed to be able to kill a groundhog, but it just, you know, that probably made it more of a passion of his. And it was all right if he chased groundhogs, but the problem was there was this neighbor, and this neighbor did not like that dog in his backyard barking all day. So if we hear the dog barking in his backyard, we have to go get the dog. So we went down and one day we hear the dog just barking tree, and he's just hollering with this franticness in his voice, and we couldn't figure out what it was. So we went out there, and sure enough, there is this dog and this groundhog, and they are in a face-to-face confrontation. They're back and forth. The dog is rah, 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 and the groundhog's teeth are sounding like a buzzsaw. And we're back and forth. And I thought, oh, we got to get these two apart. What am I going to do? So I go in there and try to get the groundhog off. And I try to get the dog. And I come over there. And as soon as I come over there, the groundhog sees the combined threat of me plus the dog as just too much to bear. And so that groundhog starts to head onto his den, and when that groundhog turns and runs, the dog has him by the back leg. He got him by the back leg, and the groundhog twisted loose. He couldn't afford to turn his back on the dog. So we call the dog, "Come on, Gypsy, come on, Gypsy, come on, Gypsy." The dog started to turn and come to us, and when he did, the groundhog was on him, and the dog had to twist along. They were locked in a fight or flight confrontation that neither could afford to retreat, neither could afford to advance. They were locked in this confrontation. There they were facing with a life and death face-off, and there they were. Well, the only thing I could finally figure is I got down on my hands and knees, and I crawled out there, and I grabbed the dog by the hind legs and pulled him backwards. And when with him facing the groundhog wouldn't advance, and when they finally got him far enough away, the groundhog took off, and that was that. Okay. Well, I got talking to some other friends of mine in Pennsylvania, and they have a dog, and their dog does the same thing with groundhogs. It gets into these big confrontations, but they live in farm country. No one cares that their dog eats a groundhog, and no one cares that the dog stays out there and barks after a while. So they get tired of walking, you know, for a half a mile across the field to get the groundhog, and they said, you know what, so they leave them out there all day. And the groundhogs and the dog are there, and they're doing this whole routine, and then eventually they get tireder and tireder and tireder. And they sit down, and one of them, they'll look at each other, and they lay down in front of each other. And then my friend said, you know what they do? They start grooming. Oh, yes, working over those hairs, getting those hairs in shape, licking them, scratching those fleas, and working that hair up, and just working them back and forth, and just grooming. They start, you know, preening their fur. And I said, now what in the world is that all about? And I said, well, I didn't know. Well, I talked to an ethologist. An ethologist is someone who specializes in animal behavior. And I said, what is that about? And he says, oh, we call that displacement. I said, displacement, huh? Yeah, he says, when two animals get locked in a fight or flight situation where neither can afford to retreat, neither can afford to advance, they start grooming. That's just one of the things they do. He says the classic example is two seagulls in their breeding territories. Their breeding territories are about 3 feet apart. They have these imaginary lines between them. You get two male gulls, and they sit there, and they'll do this whole wing wave raising routine. They do this, and they're back and forth and up and down, and they're working themselves back and forth, up and down, and making all these noises, and he says, and then they start doing a behavior called grass pulling. And they start pulling the grass. Oh, tearing up the woods. Oh, just tearing up the grass. Now, seagulls eat fish. They don't eat grass, right? And they're just tearing up the grass, just tearing it up. And he says, this is displacement. It's what animals do when they get locked in this situation. Well, you know, then I got checking in this a little further, and I started reading Robert Ardrey. You know, he wrote that Territorial Imperative. It's sort of pop anthropology. And he says, scientists don't always think of him so highly, but he tells a good story. And he says, people, yeah, they're animals too. They do the same thing. You know, you get a tough problem, scratching your head. How am I ever going to figure this one out? Oh, man. You know, doing all kinds of displacement activities. parties or, you know, say social situations, you know, when you're sort of in one of these cocktail parties, nice cocktail party, and what's your sign, and you know, you know, displacement activities, you know, we all do it, you know. Well, then I started to look at it on the international level, you know, and you realize that here you get two superpowers and they're locked in a fight or flight confrontation. Neither can afford to advance, neither can afford to retreat. What do? Just start picking on little countries next to them, just tearing up these little countries, you know, just ruining them. And, you know, so it's like you want to understand international politics, human behavior, animal behavior, anything you want. You just look at them groundhogs. All right. Thank you. Okay, we got a special lineup tonight. First, we're gonna have some pretty fancy dulcimer work. You know how you think of dulcimers as being those sort of quiet, haunting melodies from the back porches? Well, we've got a couple of special dulcimer peoples here. We got Leo Kretschner and Jerry Rockwell, and we got Ralph Gordon gonna back him up. And these guys have put out a lot of albums, and I think some of them for sale there. And you know, when I first heard Leo Kretschner, it was here at Augusta a few years ago. And what attracted me, and I bought his album, was he has this album called Bold Orion. And what I liked about it is that he had this sort of, you know, he had his sort of a cosmic awareness of it. And it was a song about Orion, how he came around. And so I think, you know, I think you'll find these guys with their, you know, their heads in the stars and their feet on the ground. And most importantly, some hot dulcimers on their laps. I think you're going to be delighted. So please welcome Leo Kretschner, Jerry Rockwell, and Ralph Gordon.
Thank you. Good evening. Well, how y'all doing there, huh? Okay, huh? You know what I thought? I thought you guys have been sitting there now for a little while, and you're gonna sit a little while longer. You might want to stand up for this first song. Why don't you? I believe. Trust me. Okay. Trust me. You'll feel better. We're sitting, but I think if you stand, that's good. That's real good. Okay. We thought we'd start off with a number that exemplifies what happens when you grow up in Detroit and learn to play the mountain dulcimer. You get the Motown dulcimer. And I wish to announce that the part of the horn section will be played tonight by my harmonica. All right, ready? You may know this, so like, feel free to sing around and move around a little bit here. You got a smile so bright, you know you could have been a candle. I'm holding you so tight, you know that you could be a handle, yeah. The way you stole my heart, you know that you could be a cool crook. And baby, you're so smart, you know that you could be a school book. Well, you could have been anything that you wanted to, and I can tell the way you do the things you do, way you do the things you do, way you do the things you do, way you do the things you, as pretty as you are. Ooh, ooh, you know that you could be a flower if good looks could cause a minute. You know that you could be an hour the way you swept me off my feet. You know that you could be a broom, the way you smell so sweet. You know that you could be some perfume. Well, you could have been anything that you want to, and I can tell the way you do the things you do, the way you do the things you do, the way you do the things you do, the way you do the things you do. Thank you. my life so rich. You know that you could be some money. And baby, you're so sweet. You know that you could be some honey. Well, you could have been anything that you want to. And I can tell the way you do the things you do. Way you do the things you do. You really sweat me off my feet. Way you do the things you do. You made my life complete. Way you do the things you do. You made my life so bright. Way you do the things you do. You made me feel all right. Way you do the things you do. The way you do the things you do. The way you do the things you do. Thank you. All right, you can sit down now. Thank you. Thank you very much. Give you a little stretch break there and get ourselves warmed up and everything. Ralph Gordon, thanks very much, Ralph. Well, Jerry and I'll do a couple of dulcimer numbers here. Ralph's going to be back in a little bit, and Karen Ashbrook's going to come out as well. Not having much fun, and I never had seen such a lovely one. All that long, long hair, I had to take a chance. So I straightened my shirt, tucked it into my pants, cleared my throat, and I rubbed my hands. And I walked right over, I wondered if she'd like to dance. It was Sandy River Bell, as I recall. We were promenading all around the hall, do-si-do and swing your partners all. Then a little bit of waltzing cheek to cheek, and my tongue got tight and my knees got weak. I could see right then I was headed for a fall. It was a little bit of fate and a little bit of luck, whole lot of hope and a little bit of pluck. As I recall, this is how our paths did cross again. It was a little bit of writing and a little bit of scheme, a little inviting and a whole lot of dream. Well, I wasn't just playing, I was playing just to win. Now it started off as just a friend of a friend, but now it's looking like something that'll never end. And if it never ends, boys, I got no regrets. That she put her hand in mine was the moment that the sun began to shine. Oh, that's a moment that I never will forget. Things are over and done, but not half as many as the things to come. The fruit that's on the vine gets sweeter, yeah. And as life goes on from week to week, yeah, we still like dancing cheek to cheek. I didn't know what hit me, and I believe I don't know yet. And if this ain't a love song, I ain't heard one yet. Thanks very much.
Well, I'm going to try a piece that I wrote for Dulcimer about 2 years ago. It took me about 2 years to write. It's kind of a kind of an impressionist piece, and it went through about 30 billion different changes, and I keep changing it still. And most recently, Leo has added kind of a nice part towards the end that you'll hear, and I hope you like it. It's kind of a real light, delicate piece. I hope it comes out. We got real good sound tonight, I think.
Yeah.
And, so I think it will. So hope you enjoy it. It's called Whisper from the Hills.